From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In a world of megabucks, film director and producer Roger Corman made a name for himself pinching pennies. Beginning in the 50s, he cranked out as many as 8 movies a year and made one of his best-known films, The Little Shop of Horrors, in 2 days. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talked to Roger Corman about turning it out fast and cheap. Also today, we talked to political scientist William Taubman. He's just translated a biography of Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, written by his son, Sergei. The biography sheds new light on Khrushchev's fall from power. Rock critic Ken Tucker gives his choices for Best Music of the Summer, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Spike Lee's new movie, Mo Better Blues. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The U.S. today strongly condemned the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait overnight. President Bush called for the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all Iraqi forces. The president also froze all Iraqi and Kuwaiti assets in the U.S. The presidential order imposes a sweeping trade embargo on imports of oil and other goods from the Persian Gulf nations. It also bans almost all U.S. exports. In retaliation, Iraq has announced that it will freeze debt payments to the U.S. Meanwhile, Iraq's ambassador to the U.S. says his country's forces will pull out of Kuwait within a few days or weeks. He also warned against any foreign intervention there. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The statement was read by Iraqi Ambassador Mohammed al-Mashat. He said his government harbors no special objectives in Kuwait and wants to establish what he called relations of fraternity and good neighborliness with Kuwait.
The event currently occurring in Kuwait are an internal affair with which Iraq has no relation.
The Iraqi ambassador said an interim Kuwaiti government asked his government to intervene. The United States rejected Iraq's explanation for its invasion of Kuwait. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher characterized the Iraqi claim as patent fraud. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Arab League ministers are meeting in emergency session in Cairo trying to agree on a collective response to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Officials from the toppled Kuwaiti government are asking the League to form a joint defense pact against Iraq. The BBC's Jeffrey Phillips has more from Cairo.
Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister, Dr. Saadun Hamadi, arrived in Cairo this evening to defend his country against what appears to be a strong Arab League reaction to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait during the early hours of Thursday. Dr. Hamadi said upon his arrival in Cairo that Kuwait was in the hands of a revolutionary government, but he would not identify the leaders of the coup that Iraq says appealed for its support and whose call has served as a pretext for the invasion. Kuwait has asked for a full summit meeting of the Arab League, but in the meantime, Kuwait's representative has asked the League to send an Arab military force to protect the emirate and for foreign ministers to condemn the Iraqi attack and call upon Iraq to withdraw.
Jeffrey Phillips reporting from Cairo. The Soviet Union, Iraq's main arms supplier, announced today that it's suspending weapons sales to Iraq because of the invasion. At the same time, the U.S. said Secretary of State James Baker will travel to Moscow tomorrow to issue a joint superpower statement on the invasion. The government of Trinidad said today that the rebels who staged a 5-day coup attempt there will be charged with murder, kidnapping, and treason. If convicted, they could be hanged. The rebels surrendered yesterday after releasing more than 45 hostages. They had taken the country's prime minister and other government officials hostage during the overthrow attempt. The rebels also overran the island country's government-run television station. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. He's been called the King of the Bees. Roger Corman is the master of the low-budget quickie, westerns, monster movies, science fiction, gangster films, and some of his movies have become classics in their genre. He directed the comic horror film The Little Shop of Horrors, which featured a young Jack Nicholson as a masochistic dental patient.
You know, most people don't like to go to the dentist, but I rather enjoy it myself, don't you? I mean, there's a real feeling of growth, of progress when that old drill goes in. I mean, I'd almost rather go to the dentist than anywhere, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Now, no Novocaine. It dulls the senses.
This is gonna hurt you more than it is me.
Oh, goody, goody, here it comes.
Corman made several moody horror films based on Edgar Allan Poe stories, like The Tomb of Ligeia, starring Vincent Price.
She will not rest with Christian dead.
She will not rest because she is not dead. To me. And she will not die because she willed not to die.
And Corman directed Youth in Revolt movies, like The Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda as the leader of the Hell's Angels.
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. And we want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time.
Corman launched the careers of Peter Fonda, Jack Nicholson, Robert De Niro, Bruce Dern, John Sayles, Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, Jonathan Demme, and Robert Towne. In 1970, Corman gave up directing to run his own production and distribution company, but he just returned to directing with the new film Frankenstein Unbound. It's scheduled for release this fall. Corman also has a new book about his 35 years in the movie business. It's called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. Corman says it was the French who first took him seriously as a filmmaker with a vision.
The Nouvelle Vague critics in Paris, the New Wave critics, started to pick up on my work, I think starting with Machine Gun Kelly, a picture I did in the late 1950s with the then unknown young leading man named Charles Bronson.
What was your reaction when, after churning out movies really quickly, you started to be taken very seriously?
Well, I was gratified and extremely pleased and possibly a little bit surprised. On the other hand, I worked very hard on those films. From the beginning, I determined, partially consciously and probably to a heavy extent unconsciously, that whatever I did, no matter how low the budget or short the schedule, I would try my best. So whatever the picture was, I gave it my best shot every time.
How much do you think the choices that you made about what movies to do had to do with personal taste, and how much had to do with what you thought would sell?
I think it was a combination of both. Generally, I would pick a movie or a subject matter that appealed to me and that I also thought would sell. Sometimes I took pictures as assignments when producers or production companies would bring a project to me, but I'd say at least two-thirds of the films or more were projects I picked.
Tell me why you wanted to make movies. Did you love movies when you were young?
Yes, I did love movies. I didn't start out to be a filmmaker. I started out to be an engineer. My father was an engineer, and I thought I also would be an engineer. I went to Stanford, took a degree in engineering, but even as I was finishing up my last year or so, I began to sense that I was probably not going to be an engineer. I started appearing in several plays at Stanford. I wrote for the literary magazine and for the newspaper, and my interests were changing. After graduation, I worked as an engineer. I remember I got a job at U.S. Electrical Motors. I started on Monday, and I quit on Thursday. I went to the personnel office, and I said, this is just a mistake. I can't come back. And I remember they said, well, why don't you come back on Friday, finish out the week? As you know, I really can't come back Friday. I really have to leave today. And so I worked 4 days as an engineer, and then I got a job at Fox as a messenger and worked my way up.
What kind of movies did you really like when you were young?
Well, when I was very young, there were certain directors, though at that time it was the era of the producers, so I should say producers and directors. But I liked the works of John Ford and Howard Hawks and probably Alfred Hitchcock the most. Later on, I began to like some of the European directors, particularly Bergman and Fellini.
So how do we reconcile, you know, someone who's an engineering student who likes, you know, pretty serious movies, and, you know, ending up turning up movies for drive-ins and, you know, movies about gangsters and monsters from the bottom of the sea. There's something about the movies that you've done and your personality from what I've seen of you so far that doesn't quite match.
Well, it may be that my personality is somewhat schizophrenic. On the other hand, what I've tried to do is to work on two levels, to do a picture that on the surface is an entertainment, can be advertised as an entertainment, whether it's a gangster film, a science fiction film, whatever, that the audience will come to see and enjoy on that level. And on a deeper or beneath the surface or subtextual level, to have some theme or statement or point of view in there that is important to me and that may or may not be important to the audience. So they can pick up on that if they want and appreciate that they got something more than the film they came to see. And if they don't want it or aren't interested, they still get the film they came to see.
A lot of incredible actors and directors got started working with you. I'd like to hear the stories behind how you came across some of them. Why don't we start with Jack Nicholson, who I think a lot of people remember his role in Little Shop of Horrors as the masochistic dental patient.
Right.
How did he come across your attention?
Well, I met Jack in an acting class given by Jeff Corey, and I'd been directing maybe 4, 5, 6 pictures when I felt I really had to learn more about acting and actors. So I enrolled in the acting class and met Jack there. From the beginning, I was impressed with his ability. He was and is a very dedicated actor who delved deeply into a character, does a great deal of research, and then is able to bring a great quality of personal humor and insight to the character and is willing to take chances to go into areas where other actors might pull back. They might prefer to play it safe.
Robert De Niro got started with you too, didn't he?
Yes, he played one of Shelley Winter's sons in the Ma Barker gang when Shelley played Ma Barker in the picture called Bloody Mama.
Did you cast him in that?
Shelley and I cast that picture together. We needed 4 good young actors, and we took Bobby De Niro and Bobby Walden from New York, where they had been working with Shelley in the Actors Studio, and Bruce Dern and Don Stroud from the West Coast. And jointly, we put that group together, and I was very pleased with it. I thought it was one of the best cast films I ever made.
Is it as easy to discover people now as it was a few years ago? Is there more competition for talented actors and writers and producers?
I think it is a little bit more difficult now. When I first started, there was less production in Hollywood and more emphasis on major studio production, so there was more room for an independent or a young producer-director such as myself to find other young actors and writers and sometimes directors when I would back a film. Today, the talented young people will more likely go directly into television and can hit faster, or the major studios are more willing to take a chance today on young talent than they were a few years ago.
A lot of your movies have been what we'd call exploitation films. What do you mean when you say exploitation film?
To me, an exploitation film is a picture that has a subject matter that will grab the audience's attention. It's sometimes used in a derogatory fashion. It doesn't bother me in any way. I think to succeed with a commercially oriented film, if you don't have a great star or you don't have a huge amount of money to spend on production value, you probably need some element of exploitation simply to get the audience's attention.
Are you exploiting the subject or are you exploiting the audience in an exploitation film?
Probably a little bit of both, or I might be exploiting the media. Because by picking this exciting or interesting or offbeat subject matter, I will get media attention for the picture, which will then bring it to the attention of the audience.
Producer, distributor, and director Roger Corman is my guest, and he has a new book called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. And speaking of new movies, he'll have one of those in the fall. It's going to be the first new movie he directed in about 18 years, and it's called Frankenstein Unbound. You are, I think, the undisputed king of the cheap, fast movie. Let's talk about some of the ways you developed to make movies that were fast and cheap. I think one of the things you've done a lot is shoot 2 movies back to back.
Yes. I first started doing that when we would go on location. The cost of taking a movie crew, even a small movie crew such as I would normally work with, the cost of taking that crew on location is fairly high. So if I would go to a location and do two pictures in the location, I could amortize the cost over two pictures. The same thing when shooting in Hollywood, if you're going to build fairly elaborate sets, I would try to find, whenever I could, a second picture that could take advantage of those sets. I would then rearrange the flats a little bit, repaint them so that they would look a little bit different for the second picture, but essentially I could use the elements twice.
Name two movies that were shot back-to-back like this.
All right. I did actually three pictures once in Puerto Rico when I took a company there. We did Battle of Blood Island, a World War II picture, and then I directed The Last Woman on Earth, which was written by Bob Towne and actually starred Bob under the name Edward Wayne as an actor because he hadn't finished the script, and I didn't have the money to take him to Puerto Rico to finish the script and take an actor also. And I said, Bob, you're playing the second lead in the film. And then when we were there and things were going well, I called Chuck Griffith and gave him the idea for a comedy horror science fiction film to be called Creature from the Haunted Sea, and we threw in the third picture as well.
So, okay, now casting Robert Towne, the screenwriter, as one of the stars of the movie, I guess that's another example of saving money.
Yes, but I knew that Bob was and is a good actor. He'd been in the same acting class I'd been in with Jack Nicholson and a number of others, and I knew he was a talented actor.
Some actors who've worked with you say that you would shoot everything in one take unless the camera fell over or there was an avalanche. Do you have any scenes that, looking back in the movies, you're really sorry you didn't do another take?
Well, that's not really true. I very seldom would walk away at the end of just one take. I'd say I probably averaged three or four takes at most times. Sometimes I would do one take, very often because it would be what's known as a one-take shot. Some sort of special effects are tearing down or destruction scene. You only get one chance at it. I remember one time I did something, one take, that I had not planned that way. It was in Little Shop of Horrors, where Jack Nicholson, playing the masochistic patient in the dentist office, has, I think, the drill, and he's dueling with a dentist who's got a scalpel. It's a slightly insane scene. And in the midst of the duel, they knocked over the dentist chair. And I said, cut, and I asked Dick Rubin, the prop man, how long would it take to put it all back up? And he said, it can take about an hour to do that. They really broke it apart. And I said, the scene ends with the falling down of the dentist chair. We're shooting this picture on a two-day schedule. We don't have time to spend an hour waiting for this to go back up.
Okay. You've often used stock footage in your movies. When do you use stock footage? Where do you get it from? This is something I've never really understood, where stock footage comes from.
There are stock footage libraries in Hollywood which have different types of establishing shots, long shots, period shots, and so forth from previously made films that you can buy the rights to establish certain things in your films. For instance, when I did a picture called The Secret Invasion, which was a war picture I did in the early 1960s, late in Yugoslavia, it started with the recruiting of certain men in different parts of the world to go on this mission behind enemy lines. And I bought stock footage of Cairo and of several other cities to establish quickly and effectively the different areas they had come from.
Roger Corman is my guest, the writer, producer, and distributor who's made hundreds of movies during his career. That's correct, isn't it? Hundreds.
That is correct.
He has a new memoir called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. And he has a new movie coming out in the fall called Frankenstein Unbound. It'll be his first movie that he directed in around 18 years. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Roger Corman is my guest. The movies he's directed include Little Shop of Horrors, Bloody Mama, The Wild Angels, Pit and the Pendulum. Some of the directors and actors who got their start working with him include Martin Scorsese, Jonathan Demme, Joe Dante, Jack Nicholson, John Sayles, and Robert Towne. You've made a bunch of monster movies and science fiction movies over the years. And now we think of science fiction movies as being based on epic special effects. You couldn't have afforded that for most of your movies. What are some of the secrets to getting cheap monsters on film or cheap outer space effects on film?
One of the techniques we used, I don't know if you could call it a trick, but a technique we would use would be to have just one monster in a movie. If you have a limited budget, my theory was put what money you have into one monster and try to do the best you can, and don't try to build five cheap monsters. Build at least one that's fairly decent looking. For outer space effects, we would build models originally and use a monofilament that you can't see to have them travel along a boom against a space background. Now, that was the kind of thing we did in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. Today, you can't really do that. You can look back at those films, and they have a certain charm in relationship to the work that's being done today. But today, you just need more expensive and better special effects. For instance, in the film I've just done, Frankenstein Unbound, we spent quite a bit of money, the most I've ever spent, on the special effects, because the audience just demands a higher quality work today. They're used to it.
Of your earlier films, which is your favorite monster?
I'd say probably my favorite monster was in The Fall of the House of Usher. AIP had asked me to do two low-budget monster films in black and white on 10-day schedules, and they were going to play them together as a double bill. And I didn't want to do that, and I said I would rather take 15 days, do one picture in color, and send it out on its own, and that would be The Fall of the House of Usher. And one of the executives said he thought it was a good idea, but there was no monster in The Fall of the House of Usher. And I said, the house is the monster. And they bought the idea at that point, and therefore the house in The Fall of the House of Usher is my favorite monster.
Okay. Any other secrets you want to share with us about making movies fast and cheap?
I think it's primarily in preparation. I do a great deal of pre-production planning. It may have something to do with my engineering background, but I like to have everything as organized and as planned as possible before shooting, so that you can spend your time shooting and not solving problems.
You've worked in many different genres over the years, and one of the genres that you describe yourself as having created is the black humor horror film, and included in that category would be Little Shop of Horrors and Bucket of Blood. Why did you decide to combine horror and comedy, and did you wonder if the horror audience would be interested in seeing a movie that mocked itself in some ways?
I got the idea of combining horror with humor at a sneak preview of one of my films when a sequence, which was designed as a horror sequence, worked very well, and the audience screamed, really screamed, very loudly. And immediately thereafter, they laughed, and then they got back into the film. And I thought, what they've done is they've reacted the way I wanted, they've screamed at the right moment, and then they realized that they'd been led into it, and they laughed in an almost appreciative way at what I'd done and what their reaction to it was. And I thought there's really a connection there between horror and humor. And then I read a book called Beyond Laughter by a psychiatrist, I think his name was Dr. Grotjohn, in Beverly Hills, in which he talked about the relationship between horror and humor. And I went to see him, as a matter of fact, paid him $100 for 1 hour to talk with him. And he told me some of his theories. And I decided to do a film that would be a comedy horror film. And that was Bucket of Blood, which I shot in 5 days, starring Dick Miller, written by Chuck Griffith. And the film was rather successful and very funny. It did just what I wanted it to do. It got the screams at the right points, and it got a lot of laughter in between. I was very pleased with it, so I tried another one, which was Little Shop of Horrors, which was more slanted towards the humor and less towards the horror. The horror was there, but it was really almost comic horror. And that picture had a rather strange history. It was very wild, rather original, and I shot it in only 2 days and a night, and I expected that I should either have a great success with something like this or a complete failure. It was so audacious a thing to do. To my somewhat disappointment, I had a moderate success. But what happened over a period of time, the picture became well known and it kept playing. Every year I would get additional rental and royalty checks. It would play at midnight screenings on college campuses, things like that. So over a period of years, it did become a rather big success.
You did around 8 Edgar Allan Poe movies, all of which starred Vincent Price. Did you give him his start?
No.
In horror?
No. Vincent had done one horror film before he worked with me. I think it was the Murders in the Wax Museum or something like that in 3D that was successful. And, of course, before that, he'd been a well-known and established Hollywood and Broadway actor. But I think it was probably in the Poe pictures that he got his greatest acclaim, starting with The Fall of the House of Usher and then going to The Pit and the Pendulum all the way through, finally, to the last two films we did in England, Mask of the Red Death and The Tomb of Ligeia.
He strikes me as such a more formal actor in a lot of ways than a lot of the actors you were used to working with. Was it different directing him?
It was slightly different. I had studied the method and was working primarily with young actors working with the method technique. Vincent was a more formally, more classically trained actor, but he understood the method, and he was a great gentleman. He was a very nice person to work with. So we got along well, and I thought he gave wonderful performances.
Your Poe movies seem, in a way, very deeply felt. And I guess I'm thinking particularly here of the Tomb of Ligeia. I mean, some of the movies you made, you were turning them out, let's face it, right? And some of them, you must have felt really deeply. I don't know what the question is, but I guess I'd like to hear about the difference for you between doing a movie that was deeply felt and one that was intended for another audience in a drive-in, and you didn't much care about the subject matter.
I'd always admired the work of Edgar Allan Poe very much, and I've read everything he's ever written. And I was very much desirous of doing The Fall of the House of Usher, and I was very pleased that the film had turned out well, and I did take the work very seriously. I had certain theories at that time, one of which is I thought that, or I believe that there are certain movements or times for change in human civilization, and I think that art and science go together more closely than people think. And I think in the 19th century, the concept of the unconscious mind was coming forward, and I felt just as Freud was moving there in a scientific manner, I think that Edgar Allan Poe was doing the same thing in an artistic way. So I tried to combine some of the theories of Freud with the works of Poe in order to bring them together on film as a synthesis.
Film director and producer Roger Corman. His new book is How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. Next time, we'll continue our interview with Roger Corman. He'll tell us about directing the Youth Rebellion movies The Wild Angels and The Trip, and his new film, Frankenstein Unbound. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There's a new biography of Nikita Khrushchev, written by his son Sergei. The book describes how and why the Soviet leader was deposed and what life was like after his fall. Coming up, we meet the American translator of the book, William Taubman. He's also working on his own biography of Khrushchev. Rock critic Ken Tucker listens to a lot of music because he has to. Today he tells us about the music he's been choosing to listen to this summer when he's off duty. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Mo Better Blues, the new movie by Spike Lee. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. World leaders are joining together in their condemnation of Iraq's invasion of Kuwait overnight. Arab League ministers are meeting in an emergency session in Cairo. They're trying to agree on a collective response to the invasion. Minutes ago, President Bush told reporters that he supports the efforts by the Arab leaders.
The conversations I had with Mubarak and with King Hussein, Mr. Saleh, all of whom I consider friends of the United States, and all of them who are trying to engage in what they call an Arab answer to the question, working diligently behind the scenes to come to an agreement that would satisfy the United Nations and the rest of the world.
The president also said that he's not ruling anything out as a U.S. response to the invasion. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher echoed Mr. Bush's comments. Meanwhile, Iraqi officials say that young revolutionaries in Kuwait asked for their help in overthrowing the country's leader. Since the invasion, Iraqi forces have installed a regime which is already giving orders. Mike Theodula reports from Nicosia.
The new puppet regime calls itself the Transitional Free Government of Kuwait. Its identity hasn't been revealed, and most Kuwaitis suspect it's an Iraqi invention because Baghdad has found no one willing to take part in an interim administration. In a number of communiques issued on both Kuwaiti and Iraqi state media, it's promised to work out problems with Baghdad and asked the invasion forces to maintain security. The mysterious young revolutionaries have also imposed an indefinite curfew, closed all ports and airports, and banned foreign travel. Eyewitness accounts from Kuwait meanwhile say the Iraqi forces appear to have been instructed not to harm the local residents. The troops appear very relaxed. One source said several went to a local barber shop for a morning shave, while others knocked on local residents for tea and coffee. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
Israel's defense minister Moshe Aaron said today that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is today's Adolf Hitler and must be stopped at all costs. Aaron's made the remarks during a television interview with ABC. He was speaking in a live interview hours after Iraqi troops and tanks invaded Kuwait. Aaron's compared Hussein to Hitler, gobbling up one country after another. Aaron said the world will not stand for such aggressive behavior. Officials in Trinidad say they will press charges against more than 100 Muslim extremists who took the country's prime minister and 54 other people hostage in a failed coup attempt. Abu Bakr and his rebels surrendered yesterday and freed their remaining 46 hostages. That ended a crisis which began 5 days earlier with the armed takeover of parliament and the government's television station. The capital of Trinidad was quiet today. People are remaining indoors, still obeying a 6 p.m. to noon curfew. Government officials say they've not yet determined the number of people killed and wounded in the coup attempt. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today as the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 35 points to 2864.60. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I'll talk with William Taubman about a new biography of Nikita Khrushchev. First, rock critic Ken Tucker has some recommendations for summer listening, starting with the band The Time.
Come here. I got real bored on a Friday night. I couldn't find a damn thing to do. So I pulled out a suit about the same color as my BMW. I drove to the party and I stepped on in just to see what I could see. Everybody knew what I was looking for. I was looking for some company. That's right. You know that.
Talking about jerk house.
I got the cash, I got the ride.
Oh no, got to make some love tonight.
And you know I got the look.
There are a bunch of very different new releases around just now that make, I think, for good summer listening. The season's best party record, for example, is probably Pandemonium by The Time. You may remember The Time from Prince's movie Purple Rain. in which the Times lead singer, Morris Day, stole the film as a sleazy but sweet hustler. Pandemonium is the Times' first album in 6 years, and during that period, two of its members, Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, became the most successful record producers of the 80s, working with Janet Jackson, New Edition, and Johnny Gill, among others. Pandemonium is wildly uneven, but it's also a lot of fun, and on No Cut is the fun more explosively funky than on My Summertime Thing. That song gets my vote for the pop anthem of the summer, and later this season you'll be able to see the Time in Prince's new movie, Graffiti Bridge. The summer's surprise hit thus far is the debut album by Mariah Carey, which made the top 20 only a few weeks after its release. Carey is an operatically trained white singer in her 20s whose pop stylistic models are black vocalists like Aretha Franklin, Roberta Flack, and Minnie Riperton. Carey has one of those big, emotional voices, and like her heroes, she can be melodramatic and self-indulgent. Still, there's no denying her talent on a song such as Vanishing.
I was so enraptured. No sensibility to open my eyes. I'm misunderstood. Now you're fading faster. It's suddenly hard to see. You're taking the light, letting the shadows inside swiftly. You're vanishing, drifting away. You're vanishing.
The summer is also a good time to get reacquainted with some familiar acts. Lots of bands from the 60s and 70s are putting out pathetic new records. I'll give you three examples: Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But one veteran group, the Allman Brothers Band, has made a thoroughly respectable comeback with their new one called Seven Turns. The Allmans were decimated by the death of guitarist Dwayne Allman in 1971, but they've managed to revitalize their trademark sound without ripping off their own best music. Another veteran act, Bonnie Raitt, is at the height of her popularity this summer with more than 2 million copies sold of her last album, Nick of Time. Warner Brothers, her label for the 9 albums that preceded that one, has put out a 20-cut CD called The Bonnie Raitt Collection that that does a pretty good job of surveying this great blues rocker's career. Fans will complain about certain omissions. This fan, for example, wants to know, where's You Got to Know How? Where's River of Tears? But if you're one of Bonnie Raitt's new fans, there's no better way to catch up with her work than by spending your summer listening to cuts like this one, Give It Up or Let Me Go, from 1972.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. Nikita Khrushchev is the Soviet leader best remembered by most Americans for the Cuban Missile Crisis and for once banging his shoe in protest at the UN General Assembly. He's the premier who succeeded Stalin and began the process of de-Stalinization. But in October of 1964, Khrushchev was ousted from office, and his name was unmentionable in the Soviet Union until the days of Glasnost. Now there's a new account of Khrushchev's fall from power. It's written by Khrushchev's son, Sergei, and translated and edited by my guest, political scientist William Taubman. Taubman has written several books about the Soviet Union and is working on his own biography of Khrushchev. Nikita Khrushchev smuggled out his own memoirs before his death. In this country, it's common for leaders to write memoirs after they leave office, but that's pretty rare in the Soviet Union. I asked William Taubman why.
Well, in the Soviet Union, when you up until this point, when you leave office, it's usually not under your own power. Lenin died in office, Stalin died in office, Khrushchev was ousted, Brezhnev died in office, his successors Andropov and Chernenko died in office. Gorbachev may be the first one who voluntarily ups and leaves and doesn't feel pressured to keep silent.
How does Sergei's memoir about his father compare to Khrushchev's own memoirs?
Well, Khrushchev's own memoirs were really not memoirs, strictly speaking. He dictated 200 hours of recollections, often by himself, without access to papers, over the course of several years, during which he got sicker and sicker. They were rather disorganized and had to be organized and put together, as they were when they came out some years ago in English. Sergei Khrushchev also dictated his notes over a period of years, but then he himself sat down and organized them and wrote them. Nikita Khrushchev never got really finally to do that. So these are real memoirs. This is a real book. The author was there from beginning to end to put it together, and in that sense, it's quite different.
Did Sergei tell you why he wanted to write a book about his father?
He didn't tell me per se, but I think it's clear from the book itself and from the correspondence that we had as I worked on editing and translating it. He feels, and rightly so, that his father was done a grave injustice, that having made a contribution to his country at great cost, he was then relegated to outer darkness for the rest of his life after he was ousted from power in 1964, and that what for? Because he began the project that Gorbachev is now trying to complete. So Sergei has felt that this is long overdue, and I think he's trying to correct the historical record, pay homage to his father, and in addition make a contribution to the current effort at change and reform in the Soviet Union.
But let's talk about Khrushchev's importance in the Soviet Union, what some of his real accomplishments there were.
Well, Khrushchev was the man who made the first break with Stalin and Stalinism. And that is his greatest contribution, for which he is still remembered and I think will always be remembered. He was the one who had the courage to get up in 1956 and to say that this godlike figure, whom everybody had worshipped and feared, was in fact a criminal. He was inconsistent, Khrushchev was, in developing this indictment. And that, among other things, has marred his image at home as well as abroad. But that contribution is something that I don't think anybody else, any of the other contenders for power, ever would have made.
How was he inconsistent?
Well, he was inconsistent in that every other month, or virtually that, he would have something good to say about Stalin. The bursts of what was called de-Stalinization, the big bursts, took place in 56 and again in 62. And in between, he seemed to be unable to carry it through. And that was not only because I think there was resistance from Stalinists, but because in his own mind, he was ambivalent about Stalin. Stalin had been his mentor as well as its tormentor.
Do you think that Sergei's memoirs offer new information about how the tide turned against Khrushchev?
I think they're full of all kinds of interesting new information, of both the everyday details about how the coup against Khrushchev was prepared and mounted, and why Khrushchev, although he'd been informed about it, did nothing. There's been a puzzle, really. How could this man, Nikita Khrushchev, who survived Stalin against all the odds, who succeeded him against all the odds, who triumphed over everyone else, how could he be toppled so quickly and easily from power? And I think that this book answers the question.
Well, why was he deposed?
Well, he was deposed because the plotters disagreed with his policies and coveted his power. They had substantive policy disagreements with him, and many of Nikita Khrushchev's policies had indeed alienated virtually every constituency that he had, the military, the party, the people. So there were plenty of things to hold against him, but it wasn't just his policy mistakes. It was also that these were ambitious men who wanted to rule.
You said that you thought that Sergei's book about his father offered new insights about why, although Khrushchev knew that he was going to be deposed, he did nothing to stop it.
Well, Sergei surmises, and I think he's probably right, that Khrushchev by the end was too tired to resist, that he rejected Sergei's report that a plot was on, but Sergei suspects that deep down he in fact accepted it. He knew, and he just refused to fight. It was too late. He was too tired. Things were going too badly. And in a sense, Sergei doesn't quite say this, but in a sense, perhaps he was relieved.
What effect did it have on Sergei to watch his father be ousted from power and to watch the whole family basically be banished?
Well, a lot of the book describes the period after Khrushchev's ouster, which we knew nothing about really until this book came out. It describes how Nikita went into a kind of dark depression for some months after October 64, and how the family was forced to give up many of its privileges, and how Sergei himself was forced to relinquish his sensitive job as a rocket engineer. How they were treated really as dissidents, and it's a sad tale, but it's also a tale of how, to some extent, the family pulled together, defending the old man, trying to lift his spirits, trying to provide him with distractions and entertainment. And then, of course, Sergei gets involved with his father in the whole effort to produce the memoirs. And one can see, reading the chapter on the memoirs, that they were not only the creation of a historical document, but they were, in effect, a way of giving Khrushchev something to live for, something to replace the power that he had lost.
Also gave him a taste of his own medicine, in a way. Didn't Pasternak have to smuggle out his memoirs?
Well, Pasternak had passed to the West, yes, the manuscript for Dr. Zhivago, for which he had been pilloried. And so Khrushchev was getting some of his own medicine. I think you're right to inject that tone into it. One one has to see the other side of Khrushchev. Back in the 30s, Khrushchev had been part of, certainly by the end of the 30s, the Stalinist leadership, which presided over the purges in which hundreds of thousands and millions were liquidated. Khrushchev had blood on his hands, and so he was indeed getting some of his own medicine.
The cemetery that Nikita Khrushchev is buried in was closed to the public for 10 years.
Yes.
And Khrushchev's name was basically unmentionable in public in the Soviet Union until perestroika and glasnost. What turned it around for him?
Well, we can actually date the moment when it turned around. It happened in 1987 when Gorbachev gave a speech on the 70th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. And in this speech, he tried to set some of the historical record straight. And in that connection, he talked about Khrushchev's contribution, his courage. And that's really when it began turning around. And there's now been a kind of a small flood of pieces on Khrushchev. Also, speaking of the cemetery, I have gone there every time I go to Moscow, and I stand by the monument, partly in tribute, but mostly, I must admit, to listen to what Soviets are saying about Nikita Sergeyevich. And over the years, as I stand there, I can track his rehabilitation in the comments of Soviets who come and contemplate the monument and, in some cases, listen to guides who were telling them about the Khrushchev. And back in 86, 87, you know, they seemed to recognize this was Khrushchev. The older people knew something about him. The younger people hardly did. Well, on my most recent trips, you can hear guides saying, this is Khrushchev. He made a great contribution. He's the one who dethroned Stalin. He's the one who did this and that. So, as I say, you can track the change by standing silently in front of the memorial.
How well is Sergei Khrushchev's book selling in the Soviet Union? Do you know?
Actually, his book has, to my knowledge, has not yet appeared in the Soviet Union.
Oh.
He chose to have it come out here first, and I don't entirely know why. The fact that he did, it might even be a kind of ironic commentary on the past, in which if your book came out first in the West, you were likely to be hounded and even arrested. Now it comes out first in the West deliberately.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome. It's been a pleasure.
And William Taubman has just edited and translated the book Khrushchev on Khrushchev by Khrushchev's son, Sergei Khrushchev. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what stories do you have on the invasion of Kuwait?
Hi, Terry. Big news indeed overnight from the Middle East, the invasion of Kuwait by the forces of Iraq's Saddam Hussein, a very powerful force, almost instantly taking control of Kuwait, the leaders fleeing the country. About 200 people said to be killed. The international reaction was fast, decisive, extremely critical of the action by Iraq. The Soviet Union announced it would cut off arms shipments, for example. We'll have reports from Baghdad, from the State Department here in Washington, also from reporters in London. And we'll talk with people in Baghdad who watched the arrival of the Iraqi planes and tanks.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Spike Lee's new movie, Mo Better Blues, opens this weekend. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Last summer, when Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing came out, a number of short-sighted critics predicted that it would jolt its audiences into violent action, even ignite race riots. No such fears this year. Lee's new movie barely keeps you awake. Mo Better Blues is his tribute to the world of jazz, and he's been using it to criticize what he calls the narrow vision of jazz films like Round Midnight and Bird, directed by white enthusiasts Bertrand Tavernier and Clint Eastwood. Well, Tavernier and Eastwood may have missed the boat here and there, but Lee's movie blubs to the bottom of the sea. It's a tidal wave of clichés and missed opportunities. Mo Better Blues is about a trumpeter named Bleak, played by Denzel Washington. Bleak has an inept manager, Giant, played by the diminutive Spike Lee. He has a good band and a steady gig, and he has two women, the stereotypical Madonna and whore, played by Spike's sister, Joa Li, and by a newcomer, Cinda Williams. From what we hear him play on stage, Bleek is not a particularly gifted musician, not nearly as good as his saxophonist, played by the brilliant Wesley Snipes. And from what we see of Bleek backstage, he's not a particularly likable guy. He's narcissistic, high-handed with his band, flirty but not kind to his women. In fact, he's redeemed only by Denzel Washington's intense electromagnetism. In this scene, Bleek is sporting with Joa Li.
How you doing, baby? You looking good to me.
What happened to you, Bleek?
What happened to me?
You had me waiting out here for 20 years.
20? Oh, my watch must be going slow. It says 15 years, but I get it fixed. So how you doing? Baby, we should have been down the club. We was kicking butt. I mean, you should have been there.
Good. I'm glad it went well.
Well, I wish you were there.
You know how I feel about clubs.
No, how do you feel about clubs? I meant to ask you that.
No. All that smoke.
Yeah.
Shoot, I'd rather sit at home and listen to your records. I mean, bother people. It's not my thing. You know?
What are you talking about?
I mean, what am I talking about?
No, not what are you talking about. What are you saying?
What am I saying?
What are you really saying?
Okay, be specific.
Yeah.
What am I saying? I'm saying that I love your music, but I don't like sitting up in some club.
That's all you're saying?
That's all I'm saying.
You're not saying that you're upset because I'm late or something like
that?
No,
I'm not saying that. That's something different.
I see.
Okay?
Well,
like that one, the movie's best scenes are jivey and largely improvised. They don't go anywhere, but they do have an infectious rhythm. But the jive is almost the only touch of authenticity in the movie. As in Do the Right Thing, whose characters inhabited a strangely cleaned-up Bedford-Stuyvesant, the jazz world of Mo Better Blues is bright, sunny, drug-free. The players live in capacious lofts and perform in big, opulent nightclubs. And the only tough questions seem to be, which girl do you choose? Oh, yeah, and which is more important, art or love? To Bleek, of course, art always wins. But late in the movie, when Bleek loses his ability to play, Lee concocts a laughable whirlwind montage of the next 8 years of Bleek's life, in which we discover that losing his art has made Bleek a better man, able to love and marry happily. How he manages to pay the rent, we'll never know. Mo Better Blues has its strengths. Ernest Dickerson's cinematography is lush and evocative, and Lee is always good at finding imaginative ways to move his camera. But it also has moments that are unforgivable, especially the ones involving the club owners Josh and Mo Flatbush, who are portrayed as stock Jewish money grubbers in what must be the most flagrantly anti-Semitic passages the movies have seen in decades. At its best, Mo Better Blues is agreeably messy, but at its worst, it's downright repugnant.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerall. Our engineers are Orji Voblaitis, Bob Balls, Dan Lachlan, and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, making exploitation movies while distributing art films. It's the second part of our interview with Roger Corman. And singer Gary Troxell tells us about making the records Mr. Blue and Come Softly to Me. There's a new reissue of the Fleetwood's records. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.